Hello and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of the performing arts scene here in the Bay Area. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with conductor David Ramadanoff of the Young People's Symphony Orchestra, who shared details about his upcoming concert, which will feature competition winners. Isabella Ivey talks about her starring role in the San Jose Opera premiere of Where Angels Fear to Tread by Mark Weiser. We'll also hear from the folks at Central Works in their 25th season to share details about enemies, foreign and domestic. Plus, critic-at-large Diane Keough will return with a cultural update from the peninsula. Stay with us. My first guest, Maestro David Ramadanoff, is in his 36th year as music director of Master Sinfonia Chamber Orchestra and includes Leonard Bernstein, Herbert Blumstedt, and Otto Werner Müller among his mentors while studying music at the Cleveland Institute in Philadelphia and at the Juilliard School. He's been closely associated with the San Francisco Symphony since the mid-70s when he shared the podium with Seiji Ozawa and Ato DeVart and developed the symphony's educational and community concerts. He also served as director of orchestral training at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music in the 1980s. In addition to Master Sinfonia, Maestro Ramadanoff leads the Vallejo Symphony and appears as a guest conductor with various other Bay Area ensembles. Since 1988, David has been music director and conductor of the Young People's Symphony Orchestra in Berkeley, an ensemble that was founded in 1936 and is the oldest independent youth orchestra in California and the second oldest in the nation. In addition to local concerts, David has led the YPSO performances on tours of China, in Australia and New Zealand, as well as Alaska and most recently Central Europe. Maestro, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And the daylight hours of KALW. You've been a guest of Sarah Cahill's on more than one occasion for her show.
Well,
I welcome you to the daylight hours.
Thank you.
Reading your bio, I'm exhausted. I just touched on a couple of highlights there. I don't understand how you can keep all of these balls up in the air.
It's exciting and wonderful to be able to do it. You go a little bit crazy sometimes when you're rehearsing three programs simultaneously in one week.
Wow. Yeah.
But it's exciting. And fortunately, I guess being somewhat advanced now, I've accumulated a certain amount of repertoire that it's many, many times it's coming back and visiting old friends and finding new insights.
A lot of muscle memory involved,
that's right,
too, I'm
that's
sure.
Right.
Well, this weekend, the Young People's Symphony Orchestra is presenting concerts in Walnut Creek, the Dean Lesher Center for the Arts on Sunday and Walnut Creek Presbyterian Church on Saturday, featuring music of Gershwin, DeFaya, Vianosky, as well as Aratunian and Ravel. Quite a program involved. Let's talk about the soloists that are part of this competition that happened. How many people were involved in the competition, and how was it formed?
Oh, my goodness. We have had a tradition of having a competition for members of the orchestra to participate. And myself and two other judges listened to about 35 young people who auditioned. We selected
all from within the orchestra.
All from within the orchestra. And we selected seven winners, three of whom are going to appear on this program, and four additional ones are going to appear on our June Pops. And the three that are appearing on this program are pianist Catherine Chen, who, by the way, is also a member of my first violin section. She's a sophomore at College Preparatory School in Oakland. She's going to be playing the first movement of Manuel de Falla's Knights in the Garden of Spain. Our second soloist is Ella Kanayama, who's 15. She's a freshman at Albany High School and is an amazing performer. Again, a member of my first violin section. And this is actually the second year in a row that she's won prizes in this competition. She performed the first movement of the Mendelssohn with us last year. And this season, she's going to be doing the first movement of Wieniawski's Second Violin Concerto. Mm-hmm. Our third prize winner on this program is trumpet player Oliver Taylor. and he's a senior at Alcalanes High School. And he's going to be doing the Aratonian Trumpet Concerto, which is one of the most exciting solo pieces for a trumpet.
Well, that's interesting you should mention that, because it's kind of off of my radar entirely. Tell us a little bit about that composer.
He's Armenian. He studied in the Soviet Union, was influenced by Shostakovich a bit and some of Shostakovich's teachers, and then afterwards went back to Armenia to be the director of the main orchestra in Armenia and also to teach as well as write composition. This particular piece is kind of an early piece that he wrote, but he afterwards wrote a number of brass concerti for different brass instruments and orchestra. And this piece was really undiscovered for quite a while until the trumpet player that he wrote it for promoted it and made the first recording of it. And now you talk with someone like Philip Smith, for example, who's principal trumpet of the New York Philharmonic, and he said this is one of the really standard test pieces in the trumpet repertoire.
Well, let's give our listeners a little flavor of the music of Alexander Aratunian, and then we'll talk more with Maestro David Ramadanov. Mm-hmm. Part of the Trumpet Concerto of Alexander Aratunian. Music of Alexander Aratunian, his trumpet concerto, which you will hear 17-year-old Oliver Taylor perform this weekend with the Young People's Symphony Orchestra under the baton of David Ramadanov, my guest this afternoon on Open Air. That is some wild stuff. I love it.
Oliver would totally agree with you. He found it very challenging, but he's also having a great deal of fun with it.
A 17-year-old kid doing this, too. I mean, where was Oliver's training?
He's been studying with teachers in the Bay Area, and I think really is very seriously interested in possible professional career as a trumpeter.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the mission of the Young People's Symphony Orchestra.
Really, it's not necessarily a pre-professional orchestra. We're trying to help create wonderful young people who happen to love music. And my concertmaster, for example, a few years ago now was at MIT. But we do get some amazing professional musicians who do come through. There was a young man who was my co-principal cellist a few years ago, Dylan Mattingly, who now is a composer. And
I've talked with Dylan on the air.
Yeah, he just had a world premiere done at the Cabrillo Music Festival this past summer and just really taking off. So we get both levels. And but it's something that creates a wonderful, safe atmosphere for people to explore music. I mean, it's really a family in a lot of respects. No one is turned away for lack of a ability to pay the tuition that we charge, which is one of our main ways of support. So it's open to everybody. And we've had people come in from underprivileged situations and find that it's transformed and change their lives.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. What is the audition process like, and how can one recommend a kid to come in?
We invite anyone who's interested in audition to contact us. They prepare a solo piece. We send out a list of excerpts that we would like for them to play on their particular instrument from repertoire we're going to be playing. And then they come and audition for me and one of our coaches, who's a coach on their particular area of expertise. And then we assess them and decide if they'll be a fit for us.
So they're coming from all manners of training in terms of public school, private school.
Yes, but just about all of them have private study on their instruments. They practically need that to reach the level of playing that that we demand, because the repertoire that we play really is professional level. There are some other orchestras in the Berkeley area, such as Young People's Chamber Orchestra or Berkeley Youth Orchestra, that are younger and are sort of preparatory for us in a lot of ways.
Well, I mentioned that you're... let's talk a little bit more about this program, then we'll talk about some of your other activities.
Sure.
So in addition to the soloists that'll be involved, what else is on the program?
There are two challenging orchestral pieces for them. We're opening the program with Gershwin's An American in Paris, and then we're closing the program with Ravel Rhapsody Espanol.
That is a challenging piece. Mm-hmm. And how often does the youth orchestra perform that?
We have three full-fledged classical programs that we do every year. Every year, we do two performances of each program. And then in June, we do a Pops program, which maybe every other year might actually turn into a pre-tour Pops program, because we do an international tour every 4 years. And then in between there, we do a domestic tour. This past summer, for example, we were part of the Sounds of Summer Music Festival in New York City, where we played in Carnegie Hall.
Oh, fantastic.
And then after that, we went up to Harvard and played there. And then we made a little, wonderful little side trip to Tanglewood, which is where I met Seiji Ozawa, who brought me to San Francisco.
Oh, fantastic. Very nice.
So the kids got a chance to see it.
Well, that must be a challenge, though, taking a group that size on a tour.
But it is.
I imagine that's where your experience with the San Francisco Symphony comes in handy, and what you were doing at the conservatory.
Well, we have a wonderful touring group. A tour company that, first of all, that supervises everything. We have a number of people who come along as chaperones, so there's a lot of support and a lot of structure.
And how do I get on the chaperone list?
Just ask. Well, and then we'll talk to you about it.
Well, the Young People's Symphony Orchestra's concerts this Saturday and Sunday in Walnut Creek. Information at ypsomusic.net. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of your many other activities. In particular, you've got a Master Sinfonia concert coming up as well.
Mm-hmm. The Master Sinfonia is a wonderful professional level, but non-professional chamber orchestra, which is based in Los Altos. And we have a pair of concerts coming up the second weekend in February. And they're going to be doing Respighi's The Birds, which is going to be conducted by my wife, who's Pamela Martin, who is also music director of the Santa Cruz Ballet Theater Orchestra.
Wow, two conductors in the family. How,
yes.
How does that work?
Well, it started out with Pam being my student years ago. But I mean, she's really built a professional credentials of her own, because she was assistant conductor for what used to be the Cleveland San Jose Ballet for four seasons. She's appeared with Ballet West in Salt Lake City. But anyway, she's doing that piece. Then Steve Paulson, principal bassoon of the San Francisco Symphony, will be our soloist in Weber's Andante and Hungarian Rondo.
Very nice.
Which will be a lot of fun. And then we're going to close the program with Haydn Symphony No. 98. And we'll be performing at Valley Presbyterian Church in Portola Valley, and then at Los Altos United Methodist Church in Los Altos Hills. And mastersinfonia.org is our website. People can check it out.
It's nice to see the San Francisco Symphony musicians getting out of Davies Hall. Because it's funny you should mention your soloist, Stephen Paulson, who is also a fine conductor. Mm-hmm. We're having one of the organizations I'm involved in is the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony.
Right.
It's a fairly new organization now under the direction of Don Harms. Mm-hmm. from the opera.
I did a rehearsal for them.
Oh, I must have missed that one.
Yeah, because Don did Mahler 4. Earlier this season, and she had a conflict with part of one of the rehearsals. Mm. It just happened because Master Sinfonia is going to be doing Mahler 4 in the next program. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, it worked out well. The reason I mentioned because we're having Carrie Bell, the principal clarinetist of the symphony, in for mm-hmm. our next set to do Weber Concerto.
Wonderful.
But it's nice to see them sharing their skills outside of the hall.
Many of them are incredibly generous people. And Steve has been a friend of many, many years since my time with him at the symphony.
So all told, how often are you on the podium in a given year? My gosh, you have how many concerts are you conducting these days?
Oh, this season, let me think. Okay, 7 with Young People Symphony Orchestra, 8 with Master Symphony Chamber Orchestra, and 3 with Vallejo Symphony this season. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, that involves, particularly with Master Symphony and Young People Symphony, weekly rehearsals.
You mentioned that this concert this coming Saturday and Sunday with the Young People Symphony Orchestra will also include some music of Ravel, the Rhapsody Espanol. Mm-hmm. Let's go out with that, and I'll thank you for coming by today, and I wish you toy, not only for this concert, but for the many more that are coming your way, and we hope you'll make your way to open air once again before the season's out.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to be with you, David. Thank you very much.
Music of Maurice Ravel to be heard this weekend with the Young People Symphony Orchestra. Music of Maurice Ravel from the Rhapsody Espanol Feria movement. That can be heard this weekend with the Young People's Symphony Orchestra under the direction of David Ramadanov. Still to come this hour, we'll be hearing from folks at the Opera San Jose. And Diane Keogh will be by to talk about some things that are happening down Peninsula Way. I'm David LaTulip. You're listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. Central Works opens its 25th anniversary season with Patricia Milton's comedy, Enemies, Foreign and Domestic, opening February 21st and running through the end of March. It's directed by Gary Graves, who's a playwright and director here in the Bay Area. Since 1998, he's been a company co-director of Central Works and directs the Writers' Workshop there, an ongoing commissioning program. And he's joined by playwright Patricia Milton. Patricia is a past president of the Playwrights Center of San Francisco and a member of Theater Bay Area Central Works Writing Group, Play Cafe, the International Center for Women Playwrights, and the Dramatists Guild as well. And she's also an associate playwright with Three Girls Theater here in San Francisco. Patricia, Gary, welcome to Open Air.
Hi, David.
Thank you, David.
Well, this is Central Works' 25th anniversary season. Let's start there, Gary, shall we? You come very highly recommended. My dear friend Ian McDonald and his wife April are longtime fans of Central Works, and they said, "Oh, you're going to have some folks on from Central Works. We're so happy."
Oh, that's great. I'm delighted to hear that. Yeah, we're the new play theater in Berkeley. We do all new plays, and this is our 25th season. It's hard to believe, but here it is. We're going to do four world premieres this year, like we do every year. And we're starting with Patricia's new play, Enemies, Foreign and Domestic. And then we're going to do We're going to turn Charlotte Perkins Gilman's The Yellow Wallpaper into a new play, which is a classic short story from first published in 1892, a classic of early American feminist literature. Story about a woman who's been locked in the attic in a rest cure that her husband has prescribed.
Oh, a Disney picture.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about the Central Works method of, mm-hmm. of developing these new plays. How does that work?
Well, when we develop a new play using what we call the Central Works method, not all of the plays we do are developed that way, but we start with a writer who has an idea for a play, and if it sounds like a good idea to us, we connect the writer with a director, and then we set an opening date, and then we set about developing it. The director casts the actors, and we meet for 10 three-hour workshops over 4 to 6 months, something like that. And the writer writes the play with the actors reading the developing script and responding to the ideas and just creating a mix of ideas and dramaturgical analysis, and that's the way we make plays.
Well, Patricia Milton, you're a part of that process, aren't you?
Well, my play that I developed with the Central Works Method in 2011 was called Reduction in Force, and I wrote a play in 5 months, which is not usual for me. It was slightly terrifying.
I was going to say, that sounds like a pretty advanced schedule.
It really was, but I have to say what Central Works does, because they've been doing it for 25 years, they're very well versed in supporting the playwright as far as getting your new play on stage. And for this play, Enemies Foreign and Domestic, I'm coming through the Central Works Writers Workshop, which is a different process, but again, I think they know how new plays develop and how to get the new play to its world premiere in the best possible shape, which is not true for all theaters, in my experience.
Well, let's come to your work that's being presented as part of this anniversary season, opening up Enemies Foreign and Domestic. Explain first the title, and then we can talk about your motivation behind what's behind the
Great.
Play.
Well, the play is essentially a family play. And I was interested in the interplay between kind of family violence, which we experience here in this country, and its relationship with warfare and our foreign policy and violence that we practice overseas. And the play basically asks questions about the roots of that violence, where it comes from, through a lens of a family play, basically about three sisters and their mother.
Well, let's talk about that foreign aspect of things. I understand part of the inspiration came from your discovering something about Somalia.
Yes. One of the things that I think intimate partner violence or family violence and warfare have in common is the secrecy aspect of it. And we are in a kind of a secret war in Somalia. We have a CIA black site in Mogadishu. We have security contractors who are using mercenaries to help train Somalia troops as well as American troops over there. And in fact, what I learned in my research is that of the 54 sovereign African states, we have a military presence in 49 of them, which was surprising to me.
Wow, yeah.
And concerning.
Sure, sure. It's shocking more than surprising. But this is called a comedy. How are we weaving, you know, this
yes.
wonderfulness that we do around the world with the
Well,
with
there's
the
a couple
laugh.
Of things. First of all, the quote that I like to use and that I constantly have in the back of my mind is from the sci-fi novelist Philip K. Dick, who is wrote the book on which Total Recall is based. And he says that in the midst of great tragedy, there is always the terrible possibility that something horribly funny will happen. And this has been my experience in my life, is that it's kind of the whole catastrophe. So I think it is possible to bring out the comedy in a situation. I think it helps people to, when you're dealing with things that are dark or difficult, to have comedy in the forefront so that people can kind of engage their intellect to think about what's going on.
Sure, there's something about that laugh mechanism that activates a different part of the brain for the thinking mechanism.
Absolutely, and releases the tension that can happen. So, of course, my favorite movie is Dr. Strangelove, which is funny. Right up to the very end.
Every time you see it, very true.
And it's about something that's not very funny.
Yeah. That's Patricia Milton. She's the author of Enemies Foreign and Domestic, which opens the 25th season of Central Works at the Berkeley City Club on Durant Avenue in Berkeley. Directed by Gary Graves. Gary, could you tell us a little bit about the cast you have for this play?
Well, it's Jan Zweifler, who is a company co-director along with me, and Danielle Thies and Maura Halloran and Desiree Rogers. It's an all-woman cast. There's three sisters, and they're somewhat mysterious. Their mother's caretaker, who's a refugee from Somalia. That's Desiree Rogers. What can I say except that they're a wonderful cast. We're in the middle of the second week of rehearsal. It's very promising. Coming along really wonderfully.
So when you're working as closely as you are with Patricia, is she in the room all the time? Are you offering suggestions for changes? Is she allowing changes? How does that work with a new play like this?
Well, yes, she's been at every rehearsal so far. She may not be at all of them, but she's always welcome to be there. The way it works is typically we ask the actors to make what's written there work to the best of their ability. And if we can't figure out, if something doesn't seem right, if a line doesn't ring true, or we just can't figure out how to stage it or something, then we start examining, well, does it need to be cut? Is it not working? Or is there something within the text that needs to be altered? And sometimes, you know, sometimes the actors will make will misstate a line, sort of, you know, just through impulse, and you know, it's like
it works.
That actually works better. So, you know, the ideas for changes come from anywhere, from me or from the actors or from Patricia, and the whole thing just slowly evolves, really.
I think it's really important to be open to that in rehearsal. And I have premiered new plays where they wanted the script set and no changes once rehearsal had begun, and it was not ideal.
Sure, sure. So talk about this process. Where do you see Enemies Foreign and Domestic going after its stint in Berkeley? Would you like to see it done?
Well, I was very lucky. After Reduction in Force premiered, I did have another production on the East Coast in Louisville, Kentucky. And I think it's, well, I don't know. I think it's a universal play. I think that it's the kind of play that people can enjoy on several levels. So I think it would be welcome a lot of places. I think the Somalia women that I've been working with say that Minnesota is a really good place for it, since there's a lot of Somali people there.
That's
and this
right.
would be
yeah,
a, good, a great play for that, for them.
So getting back to the title, Enemies Foreign and Domestic, what is the bigger terror, the foreign one or the domestic one? Or is that answered at
all?
Well,
it's really a good question. We spend a lot of money and resources, and we rearrange our lives, and we take our shoes off at the airport. we give up all our privacy. to keep us from a terrorist attack. And yet, one out of four women in the United States will experience abuse in her lifetime. And I don't think one out of four people will be attacked by terrorists in their lifetime here in the United States. So it's a question of the likelihood, and it's a question of where our priorities are. And again, this is personal relationship to, advice, is to keep the focus on yourself and to look at yourself. And sometimes I think we don't do that enough.
Interesting evening of theater ahead for folks that head over to Central Works. Patricia Milton, thanks for coming in to talk about Enemies, Foreign and Domestic, directed by Gary Graves. Gary, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you, David.
The play runs through the end of March, opening February 21st at Berkeley City Club, Central Works' 25th anniversary season, Enemies, Foreign and Domestic. Information at centralworks.org. Thanks again for coming in.
Thanks, David.
Foreigners are a noisy nation indeed in this Opera San Jose premiere of Mark Lanzweiser's Where Angels Fear to Tread, a brief excerpt from that new work. It's got a libretto by Roger Brunyate based on the novel by E.M. Forrester and unveils a collision of cultures set in motion when a rich English widow marries a middle-class but handsome young Italian against the wishes of her family. My guest, soprano Isabel Ivey, sings the role of Lilia Harriton. Isabella recently made her debut for the company as Gilda in Rigoletto, which was shortly followed by Elvira and the Italian Girl in Algiers. Isabella has been a featured artist with the Ames Festival Orchestra in Graz several times, an organization we have in common, it turns out. She's also premiered several works at her alma mater, the University of Nevada, most notably Madam White Snake, the 2011 Pulitzer Prize-winning opera for the composer of the work, Dr. Zhu Long. Isabella, welcome to Open Air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks for taking some time today. Now, E.M. Forrester is probably more familiar to listeners as the author of such works as A Room with a View, Howard Zinn, Morris, Passage to India. Were you familiar with the novel Where Angels Fear to Tread before you took on this role?
I had read excerpts of it in classes in high school and college, but I'd never experienced the full work until I decided to research it. I mean, you have to research it. So I acquired the little novella and devoured it in about a day.
So you've definitely familiarized yourself with the original work.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about your particular character, Lilia Harriton.
My character, Lilia, is 33 years old. She's recently widowed. Her husband of 12 years just passed away, so she's on a vacation, as it were. She didn't particularly care for her husband. He and a marriage of convenience, you know. She goes to Italy, to Monteriano, and meets Gino Carella and falls madly in love. And her companion, Caroline, rats on her and tells her family, the Harritons, that she's getting married again. And so they send Philip down to corral her back, and he discovers she's already married. And she's a bit of a cougar because Gino's 21.
Aha. Well, we've got to give a bit of a spoiler alert here because this doesn't end up so well for you, does it?
No, I die in childbirth offstage, sadly. No dramatic death scene for me. And then after that, Lilia is the reason everything happens. So she's an important character, but just a smaller role.
And you're done after the first act, so you can probably have a nice dinner after the first act of the opera.
Well, there's a small chorus scene that we all sing in offstage in Act 2, but after that, it's lunchtime.
So let's talk a little bit about the music a bit. Mark Lanzweiser was just receiving the ASCAP Foundation's award, the Rudolf Nissen Prize for his Symphony No. 2. That was announced just last week. Mm-hmm. Were you familiar with his music at all before coming to this?
Here's the funny thing. A friend of mine from UNLV is actually one of his theory students at UCLA. So I had known a little bit about him because when I spoke to my friend about it, he's like, oh, this is who I'm studying with. And I'm like, okay, this is the guy that just wrote our opera. So I've heard a few of his pieces. I've heard the symphony that won the prize.
Terrific.
It's beautiful.
That's, how's his writing for soprano?
Well, it depends on the soprano. No, I'm just kidding. it's very nice. There's some difficult passages. It's mostly low voice. For my role, it's medium low voice for soprano, but for the other role that I'm covering, the opera singer, it gets in the stratosphere. We go to up to like an E6, and it's a really difficult passage, but mostly I enjoy singing it.
So this production is being sung in English with English supertitles. What's it like singing an opera in English versus a foreign language for you?
It can be difficult to sing in English, which you would think, because it's my native language, it would be easier to do. But we have so many bad habits when we speak in English. We have these weird vowel clusters that we call diphthongs or triphthongs, which is when two vowels go together. And those are difficult to sing. And they also sound pretty ugly. So you have to be careful. And we don't tend to study English pronunciation versus foreign pronunciation. I mean, we have the International Phonetic Alphabet, IPA, and we use that to determine how to correctly say words. We don't tend to do that for our native language because either we're just not taught it, or we're lazy, or both. you have to work against what you already know. On the other hand, it is nice to actually know what you're talking about without having to translate it.
But you're also English.
Yes. Right, oh, we're speaking a combination of a British accent and American accent, whatever works best for singing. So we have words like, welcome to Monteriano. So we do things like that, or introduce, Pelone, things like that. So we've been practicing, we'll goof around in rehearsal and make silly British accents.
Let's talk about the rest of your cast that you're working with.
Oh, God, they're so amazing. They're just incredible. Our tenor, Kirk Dottery, incredible. He's playing Philip. Lovely voice, lovely man, doing a great job. Matthew Hanscom is playing Gino. And as I was telling you earlier, we had to change some of the lines because Matt is very tall and Gino was supposed to be short. So. But Matt is fantastic. He was our Rigoletto title role of the show, and he was fantastic. We have Chloe is playing Padrona. She's also covering Caroline. She's covering Caroline, and she's lovely, too. Just everyone is so great. Christy is the main Caroline. Just everyone's good.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked briefly about the drama involved in this. Mm-hmm. It's quite an emotional work, isn't it? We talked about your death and childbirth, but there's mm-hmm. lots more drama after that. Tell us a little bit about the story.
Well, after I die, Philip and in childbirth, Philip and his sister Harriet go down to Italy to acquire the baby. And adoption rules were obviously a little different then, so they go down there to buy the baby. No joke. And they find out that Caroline is there, and she's planning on getting the kid before them because they obviously don't want it. They're just getting it because she said she would adopt the child, and they got all upset about it. So Caroline goes and meets Gino and discovers that he really is a good father. And she decides that she doesn't want to take the child away from him because she feels it would be wrong. And Harriet loses her mind. And I'm not going to say anything else because it would ruin the surprise. But let's just say that the ending is deeply tragic.
A tragic opera in the works for the world premiere of Where Angels Fear to Tread, composed by Mark Lanzweiser, a libretto by Roger Brunette and Brunette, and conducted by Joseph Marchesio. My guest, Isabella Ivey, in one of the starring roles. So this runs through the 22nd of February, I believe.
Yes, we have 6 performances.
And some special events happening around it. This Sunday, the 1st of February, from 1 to 5, will feature both the composer and the librettist in conversation with the conductor, stage director, designers, and some guest speakers at the theater in San Jose. The Petit Trianon Theater on 5th Street in San Jose. And additionally, there's a gala dinner for the opening night on the 7th. In addition to some wonderful food of Tuscan favorites, created by a chef to bring you Tuscany, the region where this world premiere is set, you'll have a behind-the-scenes peek at the costumes, set designs, and the creation of this opera, information about the gala dinner, and all about the performances, six performances in all, at operasj.org. Isabella, I wish you a wonderful performance, as they say. I don't know why they say. Maybe you can help me with this. Toy, toy, toy.
Theater, there's a superstition that saying good luck is bad luck. I mean, there's even a song in The Producers about it. But the toy, toy, toy is actually the sound of spitting over your shoulder for good luck. So instead of actually spitting, which is gross and unsanitary, you just make the noise.
Very nice. Well, toy, toy, toy.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming in today.
Of course.
We'll hear another excerpt from this Peabody Conservatory 2012 production. In fact, there is magic in the air, which you'll hear being sung by this group of gentlemen singing in Tuscany in this next excerpt. Information about the opera, Where Angels Fear to Tread, at operasj.org. From Where Angels Fear to Tread, Mark Lanz-Weiser's writing, based on the novel by E.M. Forster, at Opera San Jose, operasj.org, for more information. Good afternoon. Once again, David Latulippe here, now joined once again by Diane Kehoe with her cultural report from the peninsula.
Yes. One of the things I wanted to say, just listening to that opera, was I saw an advertisement for it. And the thing I thought was funny was it had said, sung in English with English subtitles.
Yeah, that's true.
I couldn't quite figure that out.
It's very helpful, though, having attended many an opera sung in English, to have those titles.
Yes, it is. It is, as it is in the theater. Sometimes I think they should have that in regular theater, too. So, where do we want to go? Do we want to start with a very interesting movie?
Let's.
Okay. And that very interesting movie is Birdman. It is a satire. It's a comedy. It's a very black comedy. And it deserves every Tony that it could possibly ever get, any Oscar it could possibly get. It is just incredible. From the way it is filmed, which I'm sure you've read about, it's just one take. It looks like one take for the entire movie, and they have done it in such a way that it is seamless, totally seamless. That camera never cuts from here to there. It just keeps going to the next person, and then from there to the next one. And it's incredible.
For people that it's off their radar, what is the story about?
Well, the story is about a man who used to be Birdman. Excuse me, something like, Spider-Man and all that. But this was like 20 years ago or more. And he's kind of fallen on hard times. So he's decided to open a play on Broadway in which he will star and direct. And that'll bring back his career, he thinks. And he's played by Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton is absolutely marvelous. Do you remember him from Beetlejuice?
Sure, yeah.
And Pacific Heights and those movies, which I love dearly. Well, he's in this, and he's absolutely wonderful. He really deserves an award for this. His name is Regan Thompson, and he had been Birdman. And Birdman could fly. He could destroy things. He could destroy his foes. He could throw things on, snap his fingers, and things would fall off the wall. But anyway, he's now in this awful play that he's having trouble with. It's from a book by a Raymond Carver. And the play and the book were, what do we talk about when we talk about love? It's a four-character play, and when one of the four is hurt by a falling arc light, the search is on for a male replacement for the four. Now, this becomes the I think, the turning point of the movie. So one of the conceits of the film is finding the replacement. And as was told to Reagan by his right-hand man, who was Jack Galifianakis, Woody Harrelson's doing another Hunger Games, Michael Fassbender is on X-Men duty, and Robert Downey Jr. is soldered tight to Iron Man. However, Mike Shiner, who is Edward Norton, is available. Inside joke, Edward Norton played the Incredible Hulk in 2008. Emma Stone, who is also up for an award, is Reagan's daughter, Sam. She just got out of rehab, and she has a very bad, jaundiced view of life. And so she and Edward Norton get into it quite a few times. Edward Norton is not a nice man in this movie, not even at all. In one scene when they're rehearsing and they finally on opening night, he is, the two of them, he and this other lady are lying on a bed in front of the audience and they're undercover. And he said, "Let's go do it." And she said, he said, no. He said, "Why not? Life's, a, you know, life's just for something like this." Well, it stopped because at that point in walks Reagan as the other part of the play. But the play goes on. And he sees himself flying. And I'll tell you, you don't know whether it's in his mind or you're really seeing him flying, because he is flying around Broadway. The whole thing, by the way, takes place in the St. James Theater, which is interesting enough because there's a lot of backstage stuff going on that people don't know about when you're in the theater. And it's interesting because he plays it so well that he's walking down 47th Street in Broadway, snapping his fingers, and in his mind, cars are exploding. But of course they really aren't. But we think they are because you can see it in his head as he sees it.
Interesting.
When the film opens, he is sitting cross-legged in his jockey shorts in midair with his back to us, as if he is sitting on, and that of course is in his mind.
Right.
But we don't know this. And all the way through the movie, are we in his mind or is this really happening? And it's just marvelous. I loved it. It was weirdly wonderful. And I would say to anybody who would like to see a fascinating movie that you really have to think about, it would be a good movie to see.
A hearty endorsement by Diane Kehoe.
Yes.
For Birdman. Do go to the theater. Speaking of theater with an R-E, you've been down to Theater Works as well.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting production.
Do you remember Victor Borge?
Of course.
Well, this play, Two Pianos, Four Hands, was written by Richard Greenblatt and Ted Dijkstra. They are both wonderful pianists. But they wrote this play about 20 years ago in Canada, because they're from Canada. And they put together two huge great baby grand pianos around stage. And it opens with a very Victor Borge-like opening, which makes everybody start to smile and laugh. And what it really is a story of two young men that we follow who are taking piano lessons when they're very young and very angry about taking these lessons and getting it over with their parents that they really don't want to do this. And as they go further and further and get their parents interfere, they get a series of very peculiar teachers. Now, all these parts are played by these two. So it's very much like a tennis match, because there'll be one thing and then there'll be another thing and they'll be back and forth playing the piano all the time in between on these things. So it's quite interesting. The weird piano teachers, the parents, they get to the point where they're told, "You're never going to be able to be a concert pianist." So one of them says, "I think I'll be a jazz pianist because that looks kind of easy." And he goes and he tries out for that. And the jazz man says, "You're never going to make it here. You're never going to make it in jazz. You don't have the feeling for jazz. You have to feel it." So the other one thinks, "Well, what's going to happen? I guess I'll just get a job in a piano bar." So he gets a job in a piano bar. And there's a wonderful scene where there's a drunk in there who is just all over the stage saying, calling a friend of his, who obviously isn't his friend because he keeps calling him and nobody turns around and answers him. But he says he wants to hear Piano Man. And one of our pianists said, "Well, I just played it." He said, "You did not." So we're dealing with a cast that is incredibly comfortable doing various parts. And, of course, at the end, the two of them are playing opposite each other on a Bach piece that goes on for approximately 12 minutes. And it is magnificent. Two pianos, four hands interplaying on this piece. And all the way through it, we hear music, because when they're talking about what they want to do, we might be hearing music from the Rolling Stones, which were in there, Hoagie Carmichael, Mozart, Beethoven, Billy Joel, Elton John, Scott Joplin, Chopin, and Liszt. So it's an evening for music lovers, and it's you come out smiling.
Two Pianos, Four Hands at TheaterWorks through February 8th at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts. TheaterWorks.org for more information. Theater with an R-E, by the way. Another theater with an R-E is the Hillbarn Theater, where you came from a recent production of Amadeus. Great production. A great show. I mean, how was their production?
Oh, well, have you seen the movie and seen the play both?
Yes.
The difference is dramatic, isn't it? I had not seen the play before, but this isn't at all like the movie. It's more the story of Antonio Salieri from his point of view. He's a mediocre composer in the court of the Austrian Emperor Joseph II. And Salieri has had many conversations with and given himself to God so that he would become a great composer, his sole ambition in life. Well, at this point, enter Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, a foolish, very young man who loves to chase the girls and just have a good time. The thing is, he's also a real child prodigy who wants to be part of the royal court. So he leans on Salieri to help him. And Salieri, at every turn, undoes what he's supposed to be doing for him. As Amadeus becomes more well-known and regarded, Salieri, who's very envious, argues with God as to why Mozart was given this gift that was supposed to be his, and he vows to harm him. Watching Mozart fail and become seriously depressed as Salieri does his best to defame his is riveting to watch. Antonio Salieri is absolutely marvelously played by Leslie Lloyd as he tells the story of Salieri's account of the death of Mozart and Salieri's own coming death. It is wonderful, and Lloyd plays the part so well. He is Salieri. Mm-hmm. You really believe that he is, and he's really as evil as he says he is.
We also have to add a caveat to this, saying that Peter Schaefer's play is highly fictionalized, and there's a lot of fiction involved in this story of Salieri and Mozart. There was a rivalry, but we have to be careful about thinking of it as a historical play.
Well, neither was the movie.
True enough. Yeah. So how is the Mozart?
Mozart has a smaller part in this. He is played by a young man who is just chasing girls and having a wonderful time, but he doesn't have a very large part in it, really. He's there really through Salieri's mind and in conjunction with him arguing, telling, begging him one thing and another. But really, it's Salieri is the star of this play. The difference is, I don't know if you knew this, the play opened in London, didn't do well, came to the United States 2 years later, and after two more years, it opened on Broadway in it, the play, and got loads and loads of Tonys. But it was changed so dramatically from the movie was changed so dramatically from it. That's why it didn't come out for a while, because Schaefer argued with them. Now, if he hadn't, I don't know what it would have been like in the movie. But at any rate, good, interesting, not a happy evening, but an interesting evening.
Indeed. Amadeus by Peter Schaefer is playing at the Hillbarn Theater through February 8th. Information at Hillbarn Theater, theaterre.org. Diane, always a pleasure to welcome you back to a little update from things peninsular and otherwise.
I'm looking forward to March, because February is going to be a quiet month theater-wise, but March has loads of things happening, so I hope to see you back again.
All right, let's hear a little bit of the Mozart Requiem, and as we go out of this segment. Music, you'll probably hear it, it's part of the Amadeus production, but nonetheless key to the story of Mozart and Salieri. Here is the Recordare from Mozart's Requiem, Kürschel 626.
Thank you.
A brief excerpt from the Mozart Requiem. To close out this edition of Open Air, I'm David Latulippe. You can send me a show suggestion if you have a local community performing arts group you'd like featured on Open Air. Send me an email, david@kalw.org. Speaking of that web address, kalw.org, it's there that you can see a full archive of all of our Open Air shows. My thanks to Niels Swinkels for producing Open Air, and we'll catch you again next week here on Local Public Radio, KALW.